There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, Progressive News Director. And we have an interesting show for you tonight. We've got people from the Everglades Earth First, a young woman named Ruddy, who will talk about her commitment to protecting the Earth. We'll have Dr. Karen Dwyer talking about a setback for those folks who've been trying to protect your drinking water in Florida. We had planned to have Kim Repare from Secular Women, but unfortunately she is indisposed and cannot join us tonight. So we have a wonderful substitute, a Mr. Joe Beck with the Treasure Coast Humanists, who will talk about the same issue, religiosity in the 21st century America. We'll have the Dismog Blog fellow journalist, Mr. Steve Horn, who will be talking about pipeline issues. And then a special guest, Mr. Dave Petrovich, longtime anti-war and civic justice advocate, who will be joining us to talk about his perspective on the war drums and the continued economic depravity that is tearing the fabric of America today. You know, I want to share a few personal thoughts with you. Normally, I do my news at the top of the show, and I share some of the wit and wisdom that I've gleaned from progressive magazines across the country, stories you should know about. I bring you those because I think they're important. We have a sponsor who believes in our work. He's been able to help this show continue. I don't ask for money. We don't ask for funds. We do hope that if you enjoy and are engaged by what you hear, you will support us. You'll share our show with other friends. If you can help us and sponsor, we'd be very welcome to have you. But we've had one sponsor step forward who's really taken it to another level. That's a Florida Media Labs, and they've made us a part of what they're trying to accomplish, getting the word out. But I want to share something with you. There's a wonderful group of progressive activists currently called the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida, and there was a discussion about the recent elections that so few bothered to participate in. And there was a discussion in this meeting about how we can help convince people that this is important, how we can convince people that this is relevant, how we can convince people to go vote in an election where the differences between Scott and Crist have to be found with a magnifying glass. I heard Crist on TV today, live on a local TV channel in Palm Beach, explain his position vis-a-vis the Republican Party. He used that old careworn phrase. He said, "Well, I never left the Republican Party." "No, I never left the Republican Party," he said, because the guy never had an original thought in his head, "because the Republican Party left me." And we all know that, those of us who pay attention, that he's up until recently been praising old Jebby. Jebby, you know, one of the aristocrats who own America. Bush, Daddy Bush, the old CIA man. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, you know, I was hearing this discussion about how we need to convince people the relevance of this. And you know, it struck me that arguing the relevancy of a primary where you had a clear choice, you had a progressive woman with legislative experience, with a progressive agenda, and you'd have to be blind and deaf and in a coma to not know the difference between Nan Rich's candidacy and Mr. Crist's latest chameleon change in pursuit of public office. And, you know, if Floridians couldn't tell the difference, and we're going to try to convince them that if they couldn't get excited about Crist versus Rich, we're going to try to get them excited about Rich versus Scott. And it just seemed to me that you're fighting conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom is it's not going to make a damn bit of difference. You're just changing one set of thieves for another set of thieves. And you know, frankly, I couldn't say otherwise. The best these good progressives could come up with is, well, let me explain to you why you said that, Republicans didn't leave him. This is because of Tea Party. I said, you know what? You don't have to explain the obvious to me. Yes, I know the Republicans have taken a hard right turn. I know that. You know that. What, are we kidding each other? Armed, quote, patriots who wouldn't know the Constitution if it bit them on the ass? Give me a break. But the reason people don't pay attention to these elections, and like old Winston Churchill said, let me bring out my old hoary quote, you know, democracy really sucks except for all the other forms. Yeah, you know, you got that. But when the party contrives to present one gray plate of gruel after another, how can we look the public in the face and say otherwise? So the best I can say is find a real progressive advocate and back them. If you can't back Crist, hey, I would not try to tell you otherwise. But if you see a real progressive, a real honest-to-God progressive that means what they say, back them. Back them for all you're worth. Give them your pennies. Send them your bottle tops. Give them your trading stamps. Send them your coupons. Because those are the people, the ones that really back you, the ones that really are there for you, they are the diamonds, my friends. Mark Pafford, a diamond. You got to back them. You got to back the progressive journalists that are out there fighting against the mainstream media who you know, will give you the news on the stars, will give you the basketball scores, will tell you who beat up who on the hockey game, but couldn't be bothered to talk about fracking, who couldn't be bothered to say, hey, we're destroying our water in a drought. We're pissing our water away in fracking. You know, when the water ration coupons break out and they go, hey, support Mr. Gray because he won't rock the boat. I got to tell you, friends, you can't convince people to vote for somebody who's working against their best interests. Support the progressives. On the air, in Congress, and God forbid one could actually get in the door of the White House, you better support them. My friends, they're buying the world out from under us. They're telling us they can afford all the bombs in the world. They can afford all the weaponry. They can afford mercenaries from now till hell freezes over, but they can't afford to give you health care. They can't afford to feed the people. They can't afford to educate the people. They're selling our education system down the tubes, my friends. Whew. I'll tell you. Yeah. And like Crist said, man, you know, it's not that he left the Republican Party. Rest assured, he's still a Republican. Golly. No, he didn't leave the Republican Party. No, friends. No, the Republican Party left him. Poor boy. So he wants to take the Democratic Party where it belongs. among the milquetoast Republicans, among the corporatists. And when Susie Golden Sachs runs for president, and everybody goes, well, you know, she's got ovaries, she's got to be qualified. My God, you know, the woman, Naomi, she dealt with Bill. Jeez, you know, Missy Golden Sachs, she's got ovaries, she's got to be better than these jackasses. Well, my friends, I want you to think about it and back a real progressive. You know, so in case you're not confused, progressives protected the water supply. Progressives made sure that your food supply was safe. Progressives made sure that you only worked 40 hours in a week. Progressives got you a vacation. Progressives gave you a weekend, friends. And I know you forgot that. I know you were never trained in that. I know they don't teach that in history class. I know they don't say the unions transformed us from a society where we ate the poor, where the children of working people couldn't go to school because they couldn't afford it. Their best option was to not be killed in the factory. Now, you know, I know they tell you that, hey, crew, those unions, boy, you know, they're not working for you. They're working for themselves. I'll tell you something, friends. Read a little history. Read a little history, because you know what? They got you the 40-hour week. Notice it's gone. Notice it's gone. Okay, let's see. Union power went away. Notice the 40-hour week went away. Notice your pensions went away. Notice your benefits went away. How many out there of you good people still get benefits? Not damn many. Yeah, but, you know, they'll tell you we don't need unions. And when NPR, the the purported liberal voice, or MSNBC, the purported liberal voice, gives you the spectrum of opinion all the way from the extreme right to right of center, and calls that the full spectrum, friends, you better find a progressive broadcaster, because that's the only place you're going to hear the truth. And now the news, my friends. And now the news. Up first, billions in failed programs wasted in Afghanistan. I know you're shocked. I know you're shocked. U.S. has spent $120 billion on reconstruction in Afghanistan. Too bad Detroit isn't in Afghanistan. This is from the real news, the good people in Reader supported news. Support them, for God's sakes. Support them. Reader supported news. I urge you to support them. With most Americans' attention riveted on purpose or purposely distracted, depending on your point of view, on Iraq and Syria, because this time when we train them, they'll really stay trained, you bet. John F. Sopko, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan, said the United States' unprecedented $120 billion reconstruction investment is at risk. Duh. By the way, you know, reconstructing all of Europe, the Marshall Plan did not spend that kind of money, not even in those dollars. The country remains under assault by insurgents and in short supply of domestic revenue. The country remains riven by corruption, afflicted by criminal elements, and smuggling. Smuggling is basically the main function of government, Sopko said in a speech at Georgetown University. I would Google that, my friends. Non-Servium. Israeli intelligence veterans refuse to serve in Palestine territories. 43 veterans of one of Israel's most secretive military intelligence units, many of them still on active duty, have signed a public letter refusing to serve in operations involving the occupied Palestinian territories because of widespread surveillance of innocent residents and massive bombing. Okay, friends, I'm going to go and play our interview with Miss Ruddy of Earth First, and I want you to put aside everything you've ever thought about Earth First, and I want you just to listen. So here we go, Miss Ruddy from Earth First.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Miss Ruddy.
My name is Ruddy Turnstone with Everglades Earth First.
Thank you. With Everglades Earth First. I understand that you're still working as a group on trying to protect, is it the Bridger Forest?
It is the Bridger Forest, yes. I do have an update. Is it okay if I explain to the audience a little bit about Everglades Earth First?
I think you should. I think it's a good idea.
Great. A little bit about Everglades Earth First. We're working to build a movement that is determined to save the remaining wild spaces in the Everglades watershed. We've been around since 2007, doing direct actions ranging from blockading the construction of one of the largest fossil fuel power plants in the country, demanding that the Barley Barber Swamp be reopened to the public and protected as the dying swamp due to FPL's Martin County Power Plant. And we are a group that is a part of the larger movement of Earth First. Earth First is an international movement, and we are unified under three underlying principles. First one is no compromise in defense of the Earth. The system is corrupt and on the side of polluters and Earth destroyers. And with that, we understand that it's too late in the game to make compromises with politicians and corporations. The Earth isn't at liberty to make a deal, and neither are we. Our second thing is we have a belief in biocentrism. There are whole books written on the understanding of biocentrism, but put simply, we believe that everything, plants, animals, bacteria, rocks, rivers, mountains, all have their own intrinsic values beyond their use to humans. In addition, humans are not at the top of a food chain. Rather, we are part of an interconnected and vast web of interdependent relationships, and we need these other relationships to survive. And our final thing is we have a commitment to direct action and an all-in-the-toolbox approach to defend the Earth. Direct action means doing things for yourself instead of asking authorities to fix the problem. Direct action also manifests itself into forms of putting our bodies in the line to stop the destruction of the Earth. That can mean anything from letting up in a tree to stop a forest from being clear-cut, stopping construction by locking to machinery, and much, much more. And with that, one of our campaigns that we've been working on since 2010 is to save the Bridger Forest. Right now, they're trying to, for the last few years, Palm Beach Gardens and Palm Beach County have been trying to turn this 682-acre forest, mostly pine flatwoods and South Palmetto scrub, into a biotech. They are trying, and it's a biotech city because they want to do a few thousand homes, shopping malls, 70 acres is going to be biotech labs from the Scripps Research Institute and its biotech affiliates. We had a protest last Saturday, September 6th. It was a rally and a march demonstrating the Scripps, the pressure that we're still keeping on them after so many years. First, we protested in front of the forest to show the passerbys and the public what we're trying to protect and what needs to be protected. And then we marched right outside of the Scripps offices right now, chanting anti-vivisection chants, as they're currently testing there on that facility on the FAU Jupiter campus on mice and flies. And we have very high suspicion, if they do expand into the Bridger Forest, that they're going to be testing on dogs and cats and primates, because they already test on all of those animals in La Jolla, California, where Scripps is based out of. And in addition to that, Hendry County, they're trying to build a primate breeding facility in Hendry County right now. And so the industry for primates, to sell primates for testing, is increasing in South Florida. While Everglades Earth First is keeping pressure on the protest side, just a few days later on September 11th, the Palm Beach County Environmental Coalition filed an appeal against South Florida Water Management District construction and operations permit that they approved for Bridger. And so these are the final stages. They can do construction any time, but not only are we putting the public pressure on them, but we're also putting the litigation and the legal pressure on them still. We've challenged almost every single permit that has come out for this project, and it is a very valuable resource to the local communities that live around it, and also to the 13 or more endangered and federally endangered and state-listed species that need that forest to survive.
You know, we've just recently seen a big setback over on the West Coast where Collier County and the DEP were pressured to actually, you know, do some regulation, to actually do some enforcement. In fact, it took the Collier County Commission lawsuit to get them to move on actually just enforcing the behavior of Dan Hughes, an oil drilling and fracking company, damaging the western Everglades. Now, they just folded yesterday. The county commission said, never mind, you know, everything's fine, don't worry about it. We've seen again and again here in Florida, regulators not regulating, processes that were required to limit pollution ignored. And God knows here in Florida it's too little too late anyway. So I think you have to be applauded for standing up and explaining as well as you did. You did a remarkable job, I thought, of talking about how it's not a food chain. We're not at the top of some heap. It is an interconnected chain of life. And I think that's absolutely admirable. What kind of reaction did you get from your action last weekend?
With our protest last weekend, we had to do our own independent media coverage there. Even though we did press releases and outreach, the media didn't cover our event at all. And we had little to no, we had a high police presence, but we had no incident with the employers or the police.
I'm glad to hear that no environmental activists were arrested for their own good.
Yes, not this one. And we certainly don't, I think that's a part of direct action. Arrests are necessary, but sometimes people do have to put their bodies on the line. And I think in South Florida right now, this is an incredibly key moment for folks to start standing up and taking direct action. People of all ages, we are going to be doing a direct action training October 18th down in Lake Worth at the Quaker Meeting House. And everyone is invited to come join us and learn these protest skills and tactics. The thing is, in South Florida, it's not just Collier County. I mean, now people are becoming activated all over, realizing that the phosphate mining that's happening, how the St. Lucie River is being totally destroyed by the pollution from Lake Okeechobee, how they're trying to dredge the Indian River Lagoon and the Lake Worth Inlet here where I'm living. The impacts to the Everglades bioregion and the watershed are so cumulative and so devastating that if we all don't unite together and rise up and work together, we will lose our precious Everglades. So I definitely encourage folks to come to our direct action training. And if they want to plug in, they can check us out at EvergladesEarthFirst.net. We have a listserv that sends out announcements about events that we're holding. Just email us at EvergladesEarthFirst@RiseUp.net. And we have weekly meetings all the time. But definitely now is the time. And we are very lucky that new coalitions are forming and that a lot more of us, not just environmentalists, but indigenous folks, workers are starting to network and work together and realize how we're all impacted by corporations destroying our bioregion and politicians making deals that are allowing this to happen.
Rudy, why don't you go ahead and give the address one more time? There was just a little glitch in the audio at that moment, so I want to make sure that people can get in touch with you if they want to help.
Sure. You can reach us at EvergladesEarthFirst.net. And if you want to get a listserv, know about our events and announcements, you can send us an email at EvergladesEarthFirst@RiseUp.net.
I want to thank you for letting us know about the action you did last week and for about that training session. What's the date of that training session again?
Our direct action training is going to be October 18th at the Quaker Meeting House in Lake Worth, Florida.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Rudy. We always appreciate it. You guys are doing great work, working to protect the Everglades and protect our habitat. And as you said, there are so many more people becoming slowly more aware of what's going on. And thank you for the work that you do, and thank all the good people at Everglades Earth First for us, okay?
Thank you so much, Rick.
And now, my friends, a little update on the fracking issue in Collier County. Unfortunately, there's been a setback, and here's Karen Dwyer. Dr. Dwyer will give us the update.
Hi.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. This is the first time they've absolutely refused to hear public comment. And it just, the whole thing doesn't make any sense at all.
Let me ask you this. How was the hearing characterized? When you went down there, you were told this was going to be a statement or this was going to be a decision. How was the meeting itself posted?
The meeting itself, you know, in our write-up we have, they were going to present. They had two presentations today about the oil drilling. One was by Herschel Vineyard, the head of the DEP, and one was by Collier Resources, the mineral rights owner, about the water test he did on his property at the Collier Hogan well. So we went there, and we know that you're not allowed to give public comment after the presentation, which is logically when it should be heard. And because it was a presentation, we weren't expecting any decision to be made because it's not a public action item. It's how the Conservancy explained it to us.
Mm-hmm.
But they went ahead, regardless, before even listening to public comment, they withdrew their petition, like the DEP asked them to, because the DEP wanted them to just, you know, withdraw their challenge, because you realize that the Collier County Commission was challenging the DEP. They had
right.
a lawsuit against the DEP,
right.
and then the DEP had a lawsuit against Hughes. So they were saying, the DEP was saying, well, you don't need to have your lawsuit anymore because we're going to be, you know, suing Hughes directly for remediation and revocation. Well, our problem with that was that they shouldn't withdraw their lawsuit without securing a legal contractual agreement from DEP to meet certain requirements that the county commission had mapped out in their petition. And there were three things we pulled out that were non-negotiable that needed to be done even if DEP didn't get that lawsuit that they wanted. Even if they didn't win it, the state should still be, you know, responsible for filling these three things to safeguard our water because it was illegally fracked. We knew that oil drilling was going to be discussed, so like we always do, we invited everyone to come and to give public comment, most likely at the public comment time, because that's always where we've given public comment before, because supposedly you can, you know, that's your time to comment about anything you'd like to. You're limited to 3 minutes. So that's what we were counting on, and we sat through the whole morning. We went through lunch, rewriting our speeches and everything, because now they had already done what they should have only been considering doing, you know, withdrawing their lawsuit and signing on as interveners. So it's sort of a tangled web, but the long and the short, for the first time ever, they refused to hear public comment. We had people coming all the way from Tallahassee. We've had people coming from Boynton Beach and, you know, all sorts of people, and they were not allowed to comment.
Obviously, since the state gave a presentation, Secretary Vineyard, and the folks
right.
from Collier Resources made presentations, it sounds like we're only hearing one side of the story. And doesn't it seem odd that a side with a very much vested interest in what's going on were the one that was allowed to provide the studies? It's sort of odd.
Right. It's criminal. It's criminal. This shouldn't be allowed to happen because the Conservancy, they asked to give a presentation so we could have heard a different side, because they had their own geologists, independent third-party geologists from the environmental standpoint, because they were also interveners on that county's lawsuit, you see. So, but they refused to hear them. And until the very end, they actually did let Jennifer speak, as well as Rob Moyer, the head of the Conservancy. But the Conservancy blasted them, Rob Moyer especially. He said, this is totally undemocratic. It's a travesty that you didn't even hear public comment. And he was shocked, and he was really angry because, of course, the Conservancy, as well as, you know, us and a lot of environmental groups, have been working on this for well over a year, bringing it to the commissioner's attention. And then just to be slighted and ignored, and to only have them listen to industry, and by industry I mean Collier Resources, but also the DEP, because the DEP is in bed with industry. You know, it's the presentations they gave were just ridiculous in terms of talking about how impermeable our rock is. We don't have anything like impermeable rock. I even asked the county geologist during the break, I said, what do you think about that presentation, impermeability? I said, as far as we're aware of, there is no such thing as impermeability in Florida. And he said, well, you're right, it's like a cake. There could be holes anywhere. You would have to be measuring every foot, because they tried to put the county geologists on the spot, the commissioners, and they said, well, what do you think about those presentations? Do you think that it's perfectly safe? And he said, I cannot say that, because we need more evidence. We need to hear from more experts, because it's just not true. He couldn't say it was falsehoods, but we can say it's falsehoods, because it's full of falsehoods and half-truths. And literally, you could contradict everything they say with research from EPA documents. about injection wells, about geological surveys from the USGS, you know, from government sources. So it's just like, wow. What happened, I think, is that Governor Rick Scott said this needed to go away. Secretary Vineyard's been talking with the commissioners, and I think it's just a deal that they made with Collier Resources and Secretary Vineyard to make this go away or make it seem like the county is working with the state to solve the oil drilling problem. You know what I mean?
Let me ask you this. I understand that while there was an initial victory, later reports said that the Dan Hughes people were going to sue the state. Do we have any sense of what's going on with that side of things?
We do. I'll tell you, what we're really worried about, the only thing that is at risk at this point is the Collier Hogan drill site that was illegally fracked. We still have the 115,000 acres that lease was terminated. It won't be, you know, used for oil exploration. And we still have the Golden Gate drill site that was revoked. And in fact, it's now a watermelon field. So that those places are safe. The only thing we're really talking about now is the Collier Hogan well, and you're absolutely right. The Hughes company, they countersued so that they are trying to regain control of that drill site to put it back into production, and they also countersued against the DEP about the cease and desist order, saying they should have never issued that cease and desist order. So the Hughes company is challenging it all the way, and they might very well overturn the DEP's decision, and that puts us with absolutely no safeguards out at that drill site because the DEP is not capping those improperly plugged wells from the 1940s. We also are missing a half million gallons of flowback fluid that was on the trucking logs but just disappeared. And that would be toxic flowback material from the fracking, and that would include carcinogenics, radioactive materials, and so, you know, and so forth. And all the flowback was trucked over to Miami, where it was supposedly pre-treated and then dumped into the municipal sewer. The only problem is the pre-treatment center did not know it was fracking fluid, so they just treated it like oil and water, like brine. They didn't actually treat it for the chemicals itself. We're not very pleased about today because
we've also seen all three of these actors act in bad faith. While the Dan Hughes Corporation was under intense public focus scrutiny with DEP people on site, they went ahead and fracked anyway. If there's one thing we can count on, it's that they're not going to tell us the truth.
Right, and legally the oil industry can do it at any time. So unless they get a law up there, can they really stop industry from doing this again and again? I mean, you know, it might very well be that Hughes has strong grounds for regaining control of that drill site because of the lack of laws in place. They just stripped the DEP of all protections altogether. Intentionally, the oil and gas industry is writing the laws. I don't know. It's really frustrating because the Collier Hogan well site is a test case. It will set a precedent for how all violations are treated in the future, and we're going to have more because we still have another 330,000 acres just leased for oil operations, you know, the seismic testing.
Right.
And, the stuff that they don't tell you is that Collier Resources was there. He does not want any abandoned wells plugged because we have 395 abandoned wells that are not up to current standards on his property. He doesn't want to have to do that. He doesn't want to have the industry have to do that, and DEP doesn't want to have to do that. They don't want to acknowledge or address that threat to our environment. Unfortunately, we know it's a real threat because this is what's happened up north when people have, you know, their water contaminated. It's through the abandoned wells. That's one of the major conduits, not just groundwater, you know, surface contamination.
Well, thank you so much, Karen, for taking some time to talk to us. We wish you the best. You know we're with you. Anything we can do to help, just let us know. This is Karen Dwyer with the Stone Crab Alliance. Thank you again, Karen.
Like I said, we're gonna be out on the beach on October 18th, 4 p.m., marching on the governor's house because we just have to safeguard our water, and it looks like we're going to have to get out on the street.
Thank you again.
We've been trying to work with the meetings and everything, but we're going to just have to make it more visible And if they're not, if they're going to shut us up with inside meetings, we'll just have to have the meetings out on the streets and on the B2s and everywhere else.
Thanks again, Karen.
Yeah.
You have a good day.
And bye-bye. Have a great day. Bye.
Okay, bye.
That was Dr. Karen Dwyer of the Strong Crab Alliance, fighting to protect your water. And now we've got a different kind of freedom fighter up next. We've got Mr. Joe Beck from the Treasure Coast Humanists. You know, we increasingly see people proclaiming that they have, through their religious beliefs, the right to control your body, to control what you see, what you hear, to control your health care. And there are a group of thinking people out there saying, wait a minute, let's look at the Constitution. Let's see what the law really provides. And in fact, the founders wanted a government that was free from the constraints of religious thought. Mr. Beck, I want to welcome you, sir. How are you tonight?
Hello, Rick. Thank you very much. I always appreciate the opportunity to be on your program.
Well, Mr. Beck, I'm not quite sure of what your title is. I know you're with the Humanist of the Treasure Coast. What actually is your title, sir?
Well, actually, Rick, I'm the founder and currently the president of Humanists of the Treasure Coast, and we're an organization that strives to provide a supportive environment to people, individuals, and families who strive to be ethical but aren't religious. You know, we've all heard there's no atheists in foxholes. Well, we know that's not true. As a matter of fact, part of our work has been to make certain that the atheist in the foxhole or the airplane or on a Navy ship or in a hospital or hospice receives equal treatment, equal support, the same level of recognition that we would provide, that our country provides to the Christian or Jewish or Muslim or any other traditionally religious community.
Well, you know, now, if anyone who's familiar with the literature of the world, not just this country but Europe and the Far East as well, knows that there's always been a powerful thread of humanist, of secular thinking. Some people call it the Enlightenment. There have been many, many different guiding thoughts, not just the books of religion, but there's a book that guides the humanists as well, isn't there?
Well, that is really, had we rehearsed this, Rick, it couldn't be any better, because how is this going to ask your listeners?
It's a magical coincidence, I'm sure.
That's amazing, really. But I'm going to give your listeners a quiz. I'd like them to tell me, what is the book that the Christian community would go to learn about its values? We'll give them a second to answer.
I'm going to guess
what or the Bible, perhaps.
There you go.
What book would the Jewish community consult regarding their traditional values?
I would maybe suspect the laws of Moses or the Talmud.
Bingo. Okay. And how about our friends? How about our Islamic friends? What book would they consult with?
Probably the Sacred Quran.
There we go. Now, if you were to ask your listeners, tell me, what resources would the secular community, the secular humanist community, go to examine its values and belief system? And I think, you know, I think most people would say, well, I'm not really sure. So if your listeners learn nothing else, we're going to let them know that there are a couple of documents that outline the humanist philosophy and humanist beliefs. And if I can add, these aren't new, but we think they're more helpful than any of the traditional religious books. We know that there's currently Humanist Manifesto 2000, and there's also Humanist Manifesto 3. Both of those manifestos are probably less than five double-spaced pages in length, but they outline the basic values and beliefs of humanism. And they essentially encourage, well, I guess they would start by defining humanism. And again, humanism is essentially an outlook on life, a philosophy, if you will, that encourages us to lead fulfilling lives as individuals. And we hope those lives will aspire to bring us happiness and also contribute to the protection and benefit of humanity as a whole. That includes taking care of the environment and treating the other species that share our planet, animals, for example, in a humane manner. Now, I'm not a vegetarian. I eat meat, and so I understand that my eating meat is going to result in the death of an animal. But we want to make certain that those animals are treated well, that they're not treated harshly. We think that's a very, very rational and an attainable goal. So if our friends would look at Humanist Manifesto 2000, for example, they would see things that relate to humanism as an ethical, scientifical, or philosophical outlook. They would indicate that we hope for a better future, and we believe that mankind, humanity, we have the capacity to feed the world. There's no need for hunger. In the United States of America, it's just pathetic. It's a shame. It's a disgrace that we have hungry people here on the Treasure Coast when our country produces enough food to feed all of us. Part of the emphasis about Humanist Manifesto 2000 is we urge people to look at themselves not just as members of a state or a nation, but as part of the planetary community. And we know we agree with our religious friends who say the golden rule that I think came from Confucius or perhaps earlier than that was picked up by Christianity. And the golden rule or some version of it is essentially shared by most religious organizations. We don't claim that as being our original belief system or our original rule, but we subscribe to it. And we think the more we can put the golden rule into effect, treating others the way we would like to be treated, the better a Martin County we're going to have, the better Florida we're going to have, the better country we're going to have. Now, when people look at Humanist Manifesto 2000, they say it'll give them an understanding as to what are the values of the humanist community. They could also look at Humanist Manifesto 3, and there they have a more formal definition that indicates that humanism, it's a philosophy of life that without supernaturalism affirms our ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the greater good of humanity. Again, the recurrent theme in humanism is humans have the ability to lead good lives that help us and the broader community as well. And that's so different from the... Yeah.
Mr. Beck, let me ask you this. I have the Humanist Manifesto in front of me, the Humanist Manifesto 2000, and in the preamble it says, humanism is an ethical, scientific, and philosophical outlook that has changed the world. Its heritage traces back to the philosophers and poets of ancient Greece and Rome, Confucian China, the Charvaka movement in classical India. Humanist yes. artists, writers, scientists, and thinkers have been shaping the modern era for over half a millennium. Indeed, humanism and modernism have often seemed synonymous, for humanistic ideals and values express a renewed confidence in the power of human beings to solve their own problems and conquer uncharted frontiers. You know, it seems to me that you could almost read quite plainly the founding fathers when they claimed that you don't need kings to run a society, that humans themselves are capable of ruling themselves and their passions. Do you see a common thread there?
Oh, positively. As you and your listeners know, the United States of America was founded as a secular country. Now, the founders didn't forget to put the word Christianity into their constitution. They didn't put it in because we're not a Christian country. We're a secular country composed of Christians and Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Sikhs and humanists and atheists and agnostics. So nowhere in our Constitution is the word Christianity. Religion is in our Constitution in a couple of ways. As you know, one of the amendments says that there shall be no
Congress
religious
shall make no law.
Public office. I'm sorry, go on.
I'm just quoting, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion.
Exactly. So that's pretty clear. In other words, the beauty of America is we're a country that respects or should be respecting the religious beliefs of everyone. We know that the religious books, the Bible, the Torah, the Quran, they all contain verses that justify the killing of people who try to encourage your children to look at other religions or attend other religious services. Now, fortunately, most of the religions of the world have become tamer, have become civilized, I think because of the trend towards equality of equal rights and democracy. There are some members of all religious faiths, small minority, that unfortunately try to impose their will with violence. But we don't think those folks represent the majority of Christianity or Islam or Judaism or any other faith. But the beauty is the secular community and the religious community sincerely agree upon the value of the Golden Rule, but our challenge is to make certain that we implement that in our daily lives. And it's clear to me that we're not doing it. It's difficult to do that on a personal level. And our government, from what I see, has really kind of dropped the ball on meeting the needs of its people. And also they've dropped the ball on keeping separation of church and state active.
Well, you know, just recently we've had a Supreme Court decision that claimed that corporations can use the corporation's religious values to guide employee services and to allow or disallow certain practices or access to certain facilities. Would humanism, if humanism was the guiding principle of our Supreme Court, you know, kind of like the Constitution, would humanism claim the ability to control and define what procedures and methods and medicines that a person could or could not have access to?
Well, again, I think you're referring to the Hobby Lobby case.
Sure.
And obviously, you know, humanists value individual freedom. So, for example, if an adult, as some religious groups, you know, believe in snake handling, now we don't advise that. And we know there's one religious group that exhorts its members to practice snake handling, and they take strychnine, and hopefully thinking it won't kill them. Unfortunately, every now and then they lose a member through a snake bite or through the strychnine poisoning. But we feel those are adults doing what they're living a lifestyle that they want to live. We don't want to interfere with that. But the basic humanist philosophy is that religious beliefs, secular beliefs, are personal. We should not try to impose our beliefs upon anyone else. Our concern about the Hobby Lobby case in particular is because our Supreme Court has held that closely held corporations, for-profit corporations, Hobby Lobby is not a church or a synagogue or a temple. It's a company. They want to make money. Congratulations. They've got a right to do that. The humanist community does not believe that the employers, Hobby Lobby or elsewhere, have any right whatsoever to restrict their employees' health care coverage. We know the Affordable Care Act provides that the employer needs to be providing that coverage, and Hobby Lobby is now asked to be excluded from providing certain forms of birth control because they feel that they are that they can terminate a pregnancy. Well, again, we think it's a sad day in America when the Supreme Court rules that the corporation owner's religious beliefs can now be imposed upon their employees. The court case was supposed to be very narrow in scope. However, it's not been narrow in scope. We already have instances where Catholic organizations who were providing some form of birth control are now ceasing based upon the Hobby Lobby rule. Our concern is that you could have Jehovah's Witnesses who own a company. They could be devout Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, they may decide that they don't want to offer blood transfusions to their employees. That would be horrendous. But we believe this Hobby Lobby case would allow that to happen because the Supreme Court has held that an employer can basically impose his religious beliefs upon his employees. We think that's a tragedy. And I'm certain that most of your listeners would agree with that.
I suspect as much.
Now,
so you've taken the battle for human liberty, the ability to be free of religion in some unusual places where it's been called upon. I understand you've done some work with hospices and the request of some patients to be treated without the mysterious behavior of the sky god, so-called. You've brought humanism to succor those who wanted to be free of religion in hospitals and hospice, haven't you?
Yes. Again, we have offered supportive services to people at Martin County Hospital, or not county, but yeah, at Martin Memorial Hospital, on the now called Martin Healthcare Systems. We've also provided support to patients at Indian River Medical Center and the VNA Hospice. Our concern is that while almost every hospital in America has a chaplain or a chapel, most hospitals, when I'm talking most, I'm talking about 99% of the hospitals in America and here in Florida, do not recognize the humanist, atheist, and agnostic patient in the same manner in which the more religious, more traditionally religious patient is recognized. And the proof of that is, again, there's a chapel. Well, that's wonderful. In the chapel, there's usually a Bible, sometimes a Koran or a Torah. Where's Humanist Manifesto 2000? Where's Humanist Manifesto 3? Are there any humanist books available? Are there any books that talk about atheism and or agnosticism and morality and ethics or helping people get through difficult times from that perspective? No, that's not an accident. Unfortunately, the current Medicare laws require that a religious chaplain be part of every intake team. So we just had a recent case where a very nice atheist gentleman entered a hospice, and quite frankly, he got what I think is good medical and nursing care from the hospice. Our people are supportive of hospice. Many of our members, including myself, have donated financially to hospices. But we're concerned that the hospice directors are not providing the same level of recognition in their material, their advertising. In addition to letting their patients and family members know that they provide spiritual care and that they have a chaplain available, they should say something very simply to the effect of, for our secular, humanist, atheist, agnostic patients, support is available to them from their perspective as well. Rick, there will come a day in America where no CEO of a medical facility would allow his facility not to provide the same level of recognition to these secular patients as they provide to the religious patients. Because there will come a time in America when it will be an embarrassment. It will be so obvious that this discrimination has to stop. But unfortunately, at this time, it is not mandated that medical facilities provide the same level of recognition to the secular as well as to the religious community. And so they're not doing it. And we don't have people, the directors of these facilities, having the courage to stand up and put these humanistic values into place. But they will eventually.
Mr. Beck, let me ask you another question. Now, recently I came across a story where a gentleman was to be sworn in as an officer in the military, and he declined the part of the ritual that asked him to swear on a Bible. He asked for another document, and they really it had gone to court, I understand, and they were really going to require him to swear in a Bible. And we've also heard that in the Air Force Academy, there was a tremendous amount of Christian proselytization going on, and young people were being literally forced to attend Christian services. Now, some of this has been addressed by people in the humanist community as well, hasn't it?
Yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, at the Naval Academy, we have, or at the Air Force Academy, we have Mikey Weinstein formed the Religious Freedom Foundation. And many of his members, by the way, are Christians who are opposed to having fundamentalist Christians setting policy and telling other Christians that they're not Christian enough or they're the wrong kind of Christian if they're not born again. Mikey Weinstein also has Jews as clients, atheists and agnostics. But the key for the Religious Freedom Foundation is to make certain that our government stays out of the religion business. We want, again, make certain that we provide the same level of support for all members of the military. And let me share with you just a personal story that
Please
is very
do.
Upsetting to me. A few years ago, I've forgotten when Patrick Murphy initially ran for office. Was that about 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I remember talking with him, and I spoke to him as a citizen of Martin County, not representing any organization. I was just a citizen, and I'm speaking now just as a citizen of Martin County. I made phone calls on Mr. Murphy's behalf. And I'm 73. I broke my back in a couple places. So for me to go somewhere and sit down in an uncomfortable chair making phone calls, it takes an effort. When I get home, I ice my back because I'm very uncomfortable. And in talking with Mr. Murphy, I showed him a letter written by one of our deceased members, Phil Haycock, who was a resident over at the West Palm Beach VA, the West Palm Beach VA hospice. He got excellent medical and nursing care. But Phil asked me to help him. I typed up a letter for him where he basically said to the West Palm Beach VA people, you know, I'd like you to make certain that you provide the same level of support to the atheists, the humanists, the agnostic soldiers as you provide to the religious people. He went on to point out that he had roommates over at the West Palm Beach VA hospice, and the roommates passed away. And when they passed away, a minister and a staff person came into the room and prayed. And Phil was very respectful. He bowed his head in honoring the beliefs of his deceased roommates. And Phil asked, what will happen when I die? Is anyone going to come into my room and acknowledge the fact that I'm a humanist or an atheist? And the answer was obviously no. To make things even worse, this shows you the stress that our people are under. Phil said, Joe, I would like you to hold off on that letter until after I die, because I don't want my level of care to be impinged by maybe an aide or a nursing person or a medical doctor who somehow is extremely fundamentalist in their religious beliefs. They may not treat me as well as they should. Now, I've heard that concern from other of our members in hospitals and medical centers. Remember, when you're dying, when you're in pain, you're very, very vulnerable, and you don't want to be risking getting poor treatment. Well, I mentioned that letter to Mr. Murphy, and I thought that we had his support, that he would help us have humanist or atheist counselors or humanist or atheist secular people or humanist or atheist chaplains in the military, because obviously we have atheists, humanists and agnostics in the military. They're just not getting the same level of support. Well, I was shocked when I learned this year that Mr. Murphy had voted against having atheist and humanist chaplains in the military. Now, some people who are more sophisticated in politics than I am have said, Joe, Mr. Murphy probably just did what he thought was politically wise for him. And quite frankly, I don't begrudge Mr. Murphy doing what's wise for him, but I can't understand why he didn't say something. He could have voted. He could have abstained from voting. I would have thought at least he would have said something to the effect that I value the contributions of all soldiers, whether they be Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Hindu, atheist or agnostic or humanist. And we want to make certain that every soldier has support from his or her perspective. Now, again, this is more than just a political decision. I think you and I, we expect our politicians to stand up for the values of America. Religious discrimination is not an American value. Giving second-class treatment to certain soldiers is not an American value. Now, I don't care if it's a Republican, a Democrat, an Independent. I'd like to find out who, running for Congress in this area, will stand up for equal rights for the atheist, the humanist, the agnostic soldier, or Navy person. Who's going to do that? It isn't Mr. Murphy, apparently, but I'd welcome if he changed his mind or if his opponent changed their mind. We'd welcome their leadership. And thank you for letting me get that out, by the way.
You know, Mr. Beck, we who've been observers of the American political scene for more than a week or two understand that the simplest thing in the world to do is to chase the crowd, to do what's to do what the crowd expects of you, to listen to the voice of the mob, and just follow along with what everybody else is doing. And it takes a rare kind of human being, someone, you know, maybe with a spine, who actually stands up for the Constitution, who stands up for their own belief system. Now, one might hope that someone who's asking for your vote would give you their candid opinion. And if they can't, if they fail in that first responsibility to speak candidly of either their own beliefs or their absolute and 100% flexibility on whichever way the wind's blowing that morning, they should give us the benefit of a respectful and honest answer. So my response to you, sir,
for Congress is going to contact you and come on your program and explain to the public how they will be fighting for equal rights for all Americans. I think that would be a wonderful idea, and I hope you give them the opportunity.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, I had Mr. Murphy on before he was elected to office, and he went on and on and on and on and on and on about his, you know, his progressive credentials and how he's all for the environment and he's all for the progressive values and the progressive agenda. But, of course, what we've discovered when he's voted is that he finds that bipartisanship, I think that's spelled B-U-Y, bipartisanship, is far more important to value than progressive values like, you know, independent thought, personal responsibility, protecting the environment, because after all, there are so many votes to be gotten by, you know, pandering. And I'm afraid, Joe, there's just no more there's no more candid way of calling a spade a spade, or, if you will, a bipartisan what they are. Bipartisan. You know, I want to say to people who find a virtue in bipartisanship, you know, there's a reason for partisanship. It's called values. And if you're so flexible in your values that you can go with the Tea Party, that you can go with those who claim that government is an onerous authority that restricts ability of business to conduct things the way they'd like to do, well, then I think that person is ill-equipped to understand the value and the lessons of history, because progressive values are what made this country great. It's what built the middle class. Progressive values gave the returning veterans of World War II a college education. Progressive values gave us the working week. Progressive values gave us vacations and benefits. Progressive values allowed children to leave the factories and go to public schools. But that's certainly not the way the mob is being pushed these days. And for those who listen to the voice of the mob, I'm afraid that they're going to perish by the voice of the mob as well.
Well, Rick, if I can say something official on behalf of Humorists of the Treasure Coast, we want equal treatment for the religious community. Again, we are adamant. We don't want to see Bibles burned. We don't want to see Jews, Christians, or Muslims, or Hindus, or anyone else treated poorly. We want everyone treated equally as our country requires under our Bill of Rights. There are no exceptions. We want people treated equally. We support that. We think it's American. We think it's a great American value. And I'm hoping that we can join hands with the religious community to make certain that we implement just the honest values that I think Catholics and Protestants and Jews, we can agree upon the fact that we are in some degree our brother's keeper. The ideal of treating people as you'd want to treat yourself, it's very difficult. I mean, certainly we want to feed our families first before feeding other people. Very few of us have got the you know, the heart and soul to be whatever, you know, martyrs like Albert Schweitzer. But again, let's work together and support those candidates who are going to put together policies that benefit the community. And that doesn't mean just the valued few.
You know, Joe, I often, living where we do, run into individuals that characterize themselves as Tea Partiers or extremely conservative Republicans. And, you know, I have a couple simple questions that I always ask them, and it's odd how often I get the same answers again and again. I was buying a car from a gentleman who characterized himself as an arch conservative, a real Tea Partier. And, you know, he literally, you know, sneered at me when he said it, because he really felt that we were two different kinds of human beings, and somehow my own values were, you know, completely antithetical to his own. And I asked him a question. I said, let me ask you this. Next time you buy medicine for your child, would you like that medicine to be, you know, actually helpful? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, I hear the Tea Party all the time decrying government regulation. You know, without safety standards, medicine used to be called snake oil. I said, next time you drink water, you drink water, right? And he said, yeah, of course I do. I said, well, you know, safe water is a product of government regulation. Do you like government regulation? Oh, no, I'm completely against it. Well, excuse me. Without government safety standards, your car wouldn't be safe. Your water wouldn't be safe. The medicine you eat that you give your children wouldn't be safe. The food that you eat wouldn't be safe. And what do you think now? And he said, well, I mean, I want safe water, and I certainly want safe medicine. And, well, you know, I mean, I want to make sure that, you know, the cars are safe. I said, well, then maybe we both want the same thing. And maybe a blanket comment that government regulation is inherently evil is really not quite fully thought out. And he said, well, you know, you may have a point there. And he's not the only one that I've gotten to this little dialogue to come to have a different perspective on, you know, how the evil of government regulation is imposed on us. Well, Joe, listen, I've got to run.
Rick,
I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Rick, can I have 20 more seconds?
Sure.
I just want to say again, Humans to the Treasure Coast is open to Republicans, Democrats. We're not a political organization, and we respect the point of view, for example, of Barry Goldwater when he said he didn't want to have the religious right telling him how to vote. And we respect Dwight Eisenhower when he said beware of the military-industrial complex. So we have many, many well-meaning ethical Republicans, Democrats, independents in our group. We're not just relegated to one party. Thank you for letting me say that.
You're very welcome, my friend. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Best bye-bye. Wishes. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring you a gentleman who's been with us before, a very fine journalist, a gentleman who is a fellow of DeSmog Blog, who's been following the trail of polluters for a long time. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Mr. Stephen Horn. Steve, welcome.
Good to be back, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Sir, it's always our pleasure to have you. Steve, what's the latest you can give us on this whole pipeline story?
Well, it depends on which pipeline we're talking about here. But we'll start with the Enbridge switcheroo, as it's been called by... by a lot of the environmental groups that are fighting back against it. And so this pipeline is like the Keystone XL, crosses the United States-Canada border. It's a tar sands pipeline. And I think I mentioned last time I was on the show that I expect it to be talked about a lot more by environmental groups. And I think it will be. I think that it will be discussed a lot at the upcoming climate march. There's something called the tar sands block that will be convening as part of the march, and one of the demands of this block is that this switcheroo, which I call the switcheroo because originally it was supposed to be a pipeline called the Alberta Clipper expansion. Alberta Clipper already exists. It was approved by President Obama in August 2009, but they were hoping to expand it, and they, instead of going through with that, which they try, you know, they submitted a proposal to do so in November 2012, and just this summer they decided to scrap those plans and to pass this oil through two different pipelines and putting pumps on each side of the border, and they're pretty much doing the same thing but calling it something else and achieving the same function. And so environmental groups are obviously pretty angry about this because the tar sands will cross the border with this switcheroo, and the State Department gave them the approval to do so, and the commenting period closes, actually, I think, this coming week on that, so it's coming up really quickly. And no one found out about it until this summer, in mid-August, because it was published in the Federal Register, and the Federal Register said that basically you have 1 month to comment on it, go ahead and do it, because it's pretty much all you have. And that was the first sign of it, so you have 30 days, and I still think a lot of the country doesn't even really know about it, even though a lot more people know about the Keystone XL pipeline. So that's going on right now, and I hope that the profile is raised. I know they just had a call with reporters, and their stuff hasn't gotten – there's been more press coverage of it than there was last time we talked, but still a lot of educating to do on that. So I think that's the latest with that pipeline. I think that's the most interesting pipeline situation going on right now, because the Keystone XL probably won't be even talked about very much until after election season is over, but this one is currently moving through the bureaucracy pretty quickly.
Well, you know, our environmentalist president has given us his word that we know is certainly sacrosanct, that he'll be postponing a decision until it's politically expedient. I mean, you know, delaying.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, I think it would be interesting to look into, you know, how much was Enbridge, how much were their officials, how much were their lobbyists, how much were the board of directors, how much were they meeting with the White House in the past year or so, because this obviously wasn't just something that happened just because the White House wanted it to happen. I'm sure that Enbridge was putting significant pressure on the White House to say, to have the State Department do what it did. That's a hypothesis, of course. I haven't done the follow-up work on that. But the point being that although there's been lots of documentation of sort of the corruption, the revolving door, and all that kind of stuff with TransCanada, who owns the Keystone XL pipeline, and their interactions with the White House and that sort of thing, what hasn't really happened is, at least in the United States, looking at what are the ties between the United States government and Enbridge. I think in Canada, Enbridge is a much more well-known company. They have a really controversial pipeline that goes to the west coast of the country in British Columbia, or a proposal called the Northern Gateway Pipeline. And that one's, they're well known because of that. That's sort of the Keystone XL of Canada as far as Canadians are concerned, because it goes across the country in the same sort of way, and it's an export pipeline. But Enbridge is still a little studied company in the United States. I think very few people have heard of them compared to TransCanada, even though they're a huge Canadian corporation with a huge headquarters in Edmonton, Calgary. And so I think that I have, and other journalists have a lot of work to do to try to explain why Enbridge is a company worth paying attention to and what their connections are.
Well, these pipelines are, on the one hand, considered to be a good alternative to the casual shipment by truck or by rail, but all three of these systems of distribution of these highly poisonous materials, they all have their own peculiar bugs in them, don't they?
They sure do. And one of the things I caution people against, especially for tar sands, is heavy oil that is called in the industry, or oil sands is called by the industry, this heavy, gunky stuff that has to be super refined and very hard to
bring on the dill bit, huh?
Yeah, the dill bit. Yeah, so this is really not, it's just not a commodity that's shipped in a big time way yet on trains. Although the stuff from North Dakota, the lighter stuff that's fracked underneath the ground, that stuff is sent and packed in trains as its main method of transportation. And there's been explosions and that sort of thing because it's lighter and it's more like a gasoline, and upon impact or something that goes wrong, this is what happens. It has a much lower flash point than a tar sands, which takes a much higher of a temperature to make a tar sands explode. And so anyway, most importantly, this tar sands is being shipped much more in trains, so it's not something we can just dismiss. There are companies lining up right now seeking alternative way to move this tar sands, especially without this Keystone XL northern half. So much so, I want to give a tangible example to people. Goldman Sachs, who many people are probably familiar with for helping crash the economy in 2008, they actually just, in August, if you look at SEC forms, they formed a subsidiary called, I think it's called, I'll look right now. It's not, I don't think it's UBS. It's called, let's see here. I have it on my desktop on my computer, actually. It's called USD Partners. So USD Partners is a company that is basically owned by Goldman Sachs that is seeking to move lots of heavy oil or tar sands by rail, and they're looking to become publicly traded, and so on Wall Street. And so this is a big deal. This is one of the biggest banks on the planet is looking to cash in on moving tar sands by rail. So even though, and I bring that up because many people like to dismiss that, well, the only good way to move tar sands is by pipeline, so we need to focus all of our attention on sometimes it's just on one pipeline, on the Keystone XL. Other people will say, well, we need to focus on pipelines in general, but rail is kind of can dismiss rail. So Oil Change International issued a report basically making that argument. But, if you look at why would a Goldman Sachs be putting so much money into moving it by rail if they weren't serious about making money? The only reason Goldman Sachs exists is to make money. I mean, they're a bank, they're a big Wall Street bank. And so that's all a long way of saying that we need to be paying attention to all of these. And I think, you know, this whole thing with Goldman Sachs is a very troubling development that just happened within the past several weeks.
Well, they certainly have their mitts wrapped around some politicians, don't they?
Yeah, and, you know, Goldman Sachs is obviously, I think people are well aware, at least some people who followed the crash in 2008, they may know that Hank Paulson or Henry Paulson used to work at Goldman Sachs before he worked, you know, before he was working for the United States Department of Treasury, for example, as the head of the Secretary of Treasury. And so that's just one example of the revolving door, and there's many others in the revolving door at Goldman Sachs and the United States government. But at the same time, I think lesser known is, you know, besides the fact that they were doing stuff with you know, the housing bubble and you know, derivatives and that sort of stuff that people became aware of in 2008, lesser known still is how much, you know, how well tied into oil and gas and other coal and other commodities these same banks are. And so you can't, I mean, you can't really talk about one without talking about the other. And so this is just another good example that Goldman Sachs will literally own, you know, the transportation method for moving, potentially moving tar sands by rail, and they see it as a big business opportunity, huge moneymaker.
Well, there's been some talk about trying to up the regulation ante to try to make sure that there's going to be an increase in rail traffic of these dangerous chemistries, that they should be shipped in higher quality freight cars or container cars, but I understand there's quite a bit of resistance to that. It seems to me that whether if you fight pipelines, they go rail. If you fight rail, they go truck. We need to make this a much more holistic approach, because simply fighting the pipelines isn't really going to solve the problem, is it?
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. I mean, there's a few approaches that we can be thinking about that would be alternatives to just playing whack-a-mole. And I think that one of them would be focusing on at the extraction site itself, slowing it down or stopping it. If it's fracking, there's obviously a lot more places to do it. If it's fracking, there's lots of fields throughout the United States where that could potentially happen. The Alberta tar sands or the oil sands is just one, you know, it's one specific sort of area in the country. And so maybe part of that is stopping future projects from being developed in that area. But it's a little harder there to just shut things down, from a advocacy or an activist point of view, because it's literally one big, huge carbon bomb in Alberta, even though there's different projects. Versus in the United States, there's actually a lot more opportunities for activists and advocates, because it's happening. I mean, in some ways it's kind of scary, it's happening all over the place. In another way, it's kind of an opportunity, because it's, you know, there's lots of places where it can be slowed down. But I think that that's all to say that I don't think that it's a mistake necessarily to focus on pipelines. TransCanada is very angry that they've had to wait for this pipeline for so many years, but I think that we need to understand things from the industry's perspective and look at choke points based on what they're talking about in investor reports, for example, or what they're talking about in their Securities and Exchange Commission reports that they give to investors, and looking at the business press. I think that's where you learn about business plans, is by reading literally business reports. So I think that it's hard for me to prescribe one solution, but I think that you can find solutions in understanding what makes them money and find what choke points would be. And these executives and investors talk very frankly when they're talking to each other in the business press.
Let me ask you this. What do you see as the next big problem coming up? Are they going to be dropping a bomb on us after the election? Once they don't have to sweat this 2014 round of congressional legislation votes, or do you think it's going to wait?
Yeah. I think that after the elections in November and after the lame duck session is over, that goes to the end of the year, I expect discussion about the Keystone XL Northern Half to pick up quite a bit. I'm not saying I expect President Obama and the State Department necessarily to approve it right away, but I do expect that obviously it's right now it's not, it's only used serving campaign ads and symbolic congressional votes and that sort of thing. I think that actual discussion from the State Department and in the White House will probably have to pick up a lot in 2015 when 2015 starts. It's the same year as the Paris United Nations Climate Summit. I just think it's going to be back on the table in 2015 big time after the new year. And so I don't know what's going to happen with it. I do know that it's going to be one of the central discussions, at least in the United States and in Canada, about energy and environment and climate. On top of that, I still expect this Enbridge pipeline to simmer at least through the end of the fall. I'm not really sure if there will be legal challenges. I mean, I still think there could be legal challenges that's still on the table. I talked about there's a commenting period, but still environmental groups and other groups could challenge what the State Department did and what they approved of legally. So I expect that to those two pipelines to be big time in the debate, going at least through next year. I mean, that's my guess, unless the environmental groups don't do anything about that pipeline and just let it happen. But they've spent already a lot of time and money and that sort of thing on fighting it, so I kind of expect that to continue. Besides that, the one thing, it's sort of a wild card thing, we didn't really talk about this so far, but there's this really interesting, and it's happening right now, this court battle in Texas over importing oil from Iraq, from northern Iraq and Kurdistan. And I'm just previewing a story that I'm working on right now, but basically the oil was imported or was about to be imported illegally until the Iraqi government said, you cannot have this oil. It came from Kurdistan. It's Kurdish. The Kurds stole this oil, and that's up for debate because, you know, some people say, well, the Kurds have their own autonomy in its own country. And so there's a really interesting legal battle going on there over this oil, literally all at the same time when, as listeners know, the United States is about to bomb Iraq because of the Islamic State. And it happens to be literally in that same area. I'm not saying it's because of the oil, but I am saying...
But oh, God, no, don't say that.
Partially due to the oil, right? Right, right. What I'm saying is that it's very interesting. This case is... I mean, it's literally, if you look at the case, it's Iraq versus Kurdish regional government, but it's not happening in Iraq or Kurdistan. It's happening in the United States court because where that oil was headed. Yeah, so it's a fascinating case just in of itself, but some of the details, which I'll be writing about soon, there's actually just recently a very explosive affidavit and amicus brief that was issued in that case that I'll be writing about that has to do with some pretty serious corruption that I don't want to say too much about now, but you'll see a story about it from me within the next week or two.
Yeah, watch when you're driving your car, buddy.
I don't drive.
Good. That's good.
Yeah.
Let me ask you another question. I don't know if you've noticed. I'm sure you watch the Sunday chat shows. I have seen an interesting phenomena that I'd never seen before. I've been a religious watcher of these pantomimes for a long time. Koch Brothers and Koch Industries has been buying an awful lot of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't watch the Sunday shows, but I do know about those ads just from reading news online. Yeah.
You'd think it was motherhood and apple pie, these boys.
Yeah, no, Koch Industries doesn't usually do these types of commercials. They'll obviously fund, people know that they fund a lot of commercials on behalf of politicians through Americans for Prosperity and through other PACs that they fund, political action committees, super PACs. So that's one that's kind of well documented. But the Koch Industries just recently did a huge ad buy to promote its company because its company has come under attack by Harry Reid for the most part and by other Democrats. But Harry Reid's been leading that charge in the Senate, which is interesting. But even more interesting is that Koch Industries is going on the defensive, and usually when Koch Industries gets attacked, they kind of keep quiet. They're not really the most I mean, as a company, they have a website called Coke Facts, but they're not all that chatty.
High profile,
akin to ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil doesn't usually respond to criticism unless they really have to, but they're generally very cautious about responding to the press, as is every company, but some companies are a little bit more outspoken and do more commercials and that sort of thing. And Exxon and those companies do more TV commercials. This is a new thing for Coke Industries to be going public like this. And actually, I hate to say it, but for a lot of people who might not be in sort of the liberal progressive world, this and just sort of a general audience, they might actually like these sort of commercials because of the way that the company is presented, just like they would maybe like a commercial if Shell did it or if ExxonMobil. If I didn't know anything else about the Koch brothers, it doesn't talk about the Koch brothers. It talks about Koch Industries as a company. And so
fear,
maybe
it
will be effective
provider
for them. Right, exactly. Right. So it's an interesting maneuver by them. And, I mean, for someone who kind of studies public relations and advertising and that sort of thing, I'd be interested to see what kind of impact it has. But it definitely shows that they're taking the stuff that Harry Reid and other journalists and other advocates are saying pretty seriously, enough that they're spending a lot of money on these commercials, which it's not cheap to get a commercial on those Sunday talk shows, that's for sure.
Well, you know, the thing that I thought was interesting is here, they're a company without any branded product. Right? You know, they're not selling Coke brand tissues or Coke brand drinks or Coke brand bread or tires or airplanes.
Right.
They're just letting us know that they've got fingers in so many pies, you better be nice to them. And it also says to me that all that criticism out there in the, oh gosh, let's just call it the lefty community, that criticism is beginning to pinch a little, don't you think?
Yeah, no, definitely. First of all, to answer the branded product thing, exactly. I mean, Coke Industries isn't a known brand. If anyone knows anything about their branded products, it's from the subsidiaries. This is not a commercial for the subsidiaries. No one's, you know, Kerry Reid and others aren't really out there. I mean, it will happen occasionally in journalism or in activism.
If there was truth in
Harry
advertising,
Reid,
if there was truth in advertising, they'd call it Coke brand legislation.
Right, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, Georgia-Pacific is not being attacked. It's Coke Industries and the Coke brothers that are being attacked. So it shows that it has resonated with them all the way to the top, because the one thing I want to say about this is that they thrive on their patent or their trademark, something called market-based management. I think Charles Koch wrote a book about market-based management. And so no decision like this to spend money on ads, or the same as any company, obviously, but they take it so seriously that they've written a book about it. And no decision like this to spend this amount of money on pretty much a quasi-offensive but mostly defensive ad buy package. No decision like that would be made without it coming straight from the top. And so this was definitely a decision that Charles and David Koch most likely ordered to make sure that there's some positive spin about Coke Industries out there. So just that's a long way of saying that it has definitely gotten to them. And I'll be interested to see if either of them in the future, in the near future, maybe before the election, the next couple of months, you know, writes up some sort of article for the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or something about, you know, what they've contributed to the country and how great of people they are.
Oh, yeah, some of the most right-wing propaganda and legislation straight from their dear old daddy and his scary group, huh? That's some ancestors.
Yeah, Fred Koch. Yeah. Yeah, and so that's
the John Birch Society, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so that's actually something. I'm not working on tracing it back that far, but there's an article in Politico magazine that just came out last couple of weeks about Richard Fink, who's described in that article as the Koch brothers' quote-unquote brain. So he's sort of like the central organizer of a lot of their network and a lot of things they fund and has been for several decades, and helped them start the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And what's lesser known is that that actually started at Rutgers University, is something called the Austrian Economics Program. Austrian Economics is this kind of strand of free market and neoliberal economics that influenced the Chicago School of Economics at University of Chicago and Milton Friedman and that crowd. And so I've actually put in some open records requests and historical archives requests at Rutgers University and at George Mason University for some of the precursors of the Mercatus Center after it left Rutgers. And so that'll be, I mean, that's another story I'm working on, is looking at the roots,
Steve,
of kind of the rise.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. You're always a font of information, and I look forward to hearing about that next investigation. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, good talking to you, Steve.
You too.
Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a special guest for you tonight, Mr. Dave Petrovich, who is an activist in the anti-war community or the pro-peace community, an activist in the anti-foreclosure arena. Dave, welcome, sir.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's our pleasure, Dave. You know, this show
I
specializes...
I want to tell you that the lineup you had tonight, your guests are articulate and informative, and I'm going to tune into your show more regularly.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. Our goal is to provide the voices of the activists to the activist community. You know, so many of us are news junkies. We want to stay informed. We want to stay involved. And, of course, mainstream media provides nothing for us. So I try to give this show as a forum for innovative and original progressive thought. Dave, that's why you're here. Welcome.
Thank you. We refer to mainstream media as lame stream media.
Well, there's a lot of names for them, some of which are fit for broadcast in a family show, and thank God this isn't a family show, so we call it the way we see it. Dave, one of the things I like to ask my first-timers is, you know, for most people, just making a living, keeping family together is more than work enough. But it takes a special breed, I think, a special kind of person to say, look, not only am I going to do that, but I got to help. I got to be part of the solution. Dave, what was it in your young life that made you think, you know, you got to put your shoulder to the wheel? What was it for you, Dave?
Well, frankly, I grew up in a very radical family. I started 50 years ago helping my father and maternal grandfather collect ballot access petition signatures, you know, on street corners. So I grew up with that. My father was a student of Marxism, and we had family discussions. You know, every holiday the family would get together. We had aunts and uncles and cousins, and we'd engage. It was really a boot camp. It was less, you know, a Thanksgiving or a Christmas dinner. It was a political boot camp. So we would analyze, you know, current events. We'd look at things, and the perspective that I was afforded growing up was very confusing to me. You know, we talk about mainstream media, we talk about textbooks that schools are using and the newspapers and the magazines and the media portrayed things much differently than my understanding of how things were. So I looked at things critically, and it was difficult.
So as I
matured, you know, I began to look at things, you know, many issues that we're faced with today. One of the reasons why I'm involved in activism per se is to help all of the single issue advocates realize that these problems are interconnected.
Absolutely.
And we have to realize that and just say, well, you know, healthcare alone, we're going to get single payer and that'll take care of everything. Or we're going to get money out of politics and that will take care of everything. Or we're going to, you know, stop fracking, we're going to stop our dependence upon oil and that will solve everything. Well, no. Those are all symptoms of a decaying system, a decaying economic system. And we have to set aside our false sense of beliefs that are just, we're bombarded with from the media, and realize that we all have a common enemy. You might not agree with that, but that's the way I see it, and I've spent 50 years, you know, appreciating that. So we as activists have to join together. We have to, instead of standing alone, we have to stand together or we will fall apart.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, my activism began, I was quite young. I had an uncle that was an anthropologist and history teacher profession, and he lent me some books on cultural anthropology. And I remember reading about Native American culture and thinking that my sympathies lied far more with the indigenous peoples of the Americas than it did with the cowboys that all my friends wanted to be on the weekends and play. And I completely understood the civil rights challenges that we faced in the 60s and, of course, continue to fight today as a part of that same force and that same racism. And the Vietnam War and those battles in the 60s, I moved from Pennsylvania to Florida to find the schools in 1967 still completely segregated in Florida. And it was appalling to me. I grew up in Pittsburgh, and there was enough commonality of interest from the Union days that part of it, that worst side of racism, had dulled a little. The edge wasn't as keen and cutting as it was down here in the South. When you were coming through schools and entering the college years and the Vietnam era days, I'm sure you took part in those issues as well back then.
Well, I was certainly aware of them, and I looked from a material point of view. Just getting back to the textbooks that were loaned to you by your associates, I'm reading a book now. It's called Lies My History Teacher Told Me. Very, very, very close to that. And it, it takes off from Howard Zinn's history of the
sure.
United States.
Sure.
And it's great to see it in print, you know, the things that I had been exposed to, you know, growing up and now reading, it's really fascinating. You were talking about the Indians. Hell, they were here long before we were. They were civilized.
Yeah.
And we actually, this whole imperial and empire building, it really destroyed. And to this day, it's doing the same thing. You know, you look around the globe and just the pursuit of, raw materials and labor and markets, it's really, it is devolving. We are not evolving, in my opinion.
One of the things that I saw in some of your material was you I thought, brought an important focus on the issue of foreclosure, which too many people think is an issue that's behind us now. But it's really not.
Oh, no. It's we're seeing right now a lull in foreclosure activity because the courts and behind the scenes, they're trying to figure out how we're going to get out of this. There are many people who believe, and I'm one of them, that most of the mortgage loans that were written after 2002 and between 2008 and 2009 are unenforceable as mortgage loans. So the investors who purchased securities that were backed by mortgage loans have found that they own worthless securities. And there are battles going on in courts today that are trying for these investors are trying to hold the lending institutions accountable, so there are lawsuits back and forth. Once that's resolved, once they can figure out how the investors are going to be made whole, we're going to see the foreclosure, the numbers escalate tremendously. So when I talk to people, is that confusing?
No, not at all.
Is that confusing? Okay.
No, I think you made perfect sense.
So these battles are now reaching to a point where some people are actually challenging the validity of the loan documents themselves. They're saying, we never had a meeting of the minds. There was no loan contract because the very people who were loaning the money were cloaked. They were not part of the original loan contract. Therefore, there was no loan. And if there was no loan, then the mortgage itself could be worthless. And there are many courts that are finding in favor of homeowners who are challenging the very documents. And that's very, very frightening to the investment community, because there are, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars in investment securities that could very well be worthless. And that's frightening. I talk to people when they come to me about foreclosure problems, and I ask them, well, you've been making payments. Do you know you're making payments to the right people? If they've been foreclosed upon, do the documents really state who has loaned the money? And just because a lender forecloses and says, we own the right to your payment, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's true. And it's a fairly complex process to really determine whom you owe your money to, and that's what's coming out in the courts now. Many of these lenders are blustering and forcing their way into courts, providing fraudulent documents. You've heard of robo-signing. Robo-signing was not a cute little, well, you're in Florida, right? Wow. robo-signing was not a cute, error where someone was just signing documents they didn't know what they were signing. Robo-signing involved the creation of documents retroactively, so they could provide them to the courts. They were providing fake documents in order to foreclose.
If that was somebody who wasn't a banker, wouldn't that be called fraud?
It's any way you look at it, it's fraud. But you don't see these guys going to jail.
Oh, God, no. No, with bankers, we look forward, not backwards. We have an interesting situation here in Florida. When we had investigators actually investigating the situation, the state had a simple answer. They just fired him. And I've heard recently some real estate reports saying, good news, houses are selling in Florida. Then as an afterthought, they said, well, oddly enough, all the housing transactions recently have been in cash. Now, what does that tell you about these transactions? These aren't homeowners buying these homes. This is not families moving in. This is
investment.
Oh, no,
these are hedge funds that are coming in, swooping in on foreclosed property. Unfortunately, many, many, many people give up in the foreclosure process. They either deed their home prematurely back to the lender, to avoid the foreclosure, or they simply abandon their homes. And that's arguably the worst thing that they could possibly do. They really ought to not be afraid, not be intimidated. They should dig their heels in and challenge the lenders. And, if you have to go, interview, 15, 20, 30 attorneys and find someone who understands this, and the Internet is filled with attorneys who are literally biting the hand that has fed them in the past. You go against the lenders and you're really sacrificing your career because you'll never work for them again.
I had an interesting perspective when my wife and I sold our house. In the middle of that whole 2004 real estate fudge factor smogabank, how rigorous the banks dealt with their documents. My wife and I were co-debtors in a house, in a mortgage, and when we sold it, they cut us a check, not doing what I had asked them to do, but they cut us a check that was in both our names. And unfortunately, after three attempts to get this check, we finally got it. And it turned out that when I went to go cash it, I had to go alone. And so this check written to two people, I managed to cash by going to a specific banker that my seller, mortgage seller, sent me to. And he said it didn't really matter that the check was for two people. He would let one person sign off on it. And it just seemed to me it was one more example of how the documents are important. Documents must be rigorously followed, except when they're not rigorously followed and except when they just want to do something different. And so I'm not terribly surprised by this whole situation. I know when we went to buy our home, they said, well, you know, you can take this much money out. And I said, I don't want that much money. I want to get the loan that I want for the amount that I want, because that's the mortgage I can pay for. And they offered us all kinds of money, but I just refused to bite for that bait. And when I asked a banker friend, I said, you know, it seems to me not difficult to understand. If these people are packaging loans that they can't explain, that they can't document, and they're saying that these things, they're trash, but we're selling them like hotcakes. We just can't get enough mortgages to sell. It's very simple to explain what's going on. It's just simply fraud, that's all. He said, well, Richard, it's so complicated we can't even explain it to ourselves. And I said, well, there's a simple explanation for loans that are so complicated you can't explain it. It's because you don't want to explain it.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, people were seduced into buying homes that they really didn't need or couldn't afford. The larger the loan that was originated, the more saleable it was to the investors who were buying these securities. And the originators were making money hand over fist. Many times they were making $10,000 or $20,000. Just for producing, small loans, because the profits were so immeasurable to the investors and to the security houses that were just pumping these things out. So we had the inflated values of the home. We had appraisers who were, I don't blame the appraisers because, everyone is really dependent upon a paycheck, and the lenders were really, controlling the shots on the entire process. Wall Street was controlling this entire, they created this, and even our regulatory agencies, the FDIC, when they were confronted with problems, their solutions were, we'll just take care of it over here and we really don't care what happens. And that's because they're all complicit anyway.
Dave, let me ask you this. See the same panoply of errors and issues that I see. You see the pollution. You see the aggressive warmongering. You see the economic vampirism. You see a mainstream media that is either a cheerleader or a misdirector, whichever way you want to put it. What do you advise the progressive community? What suggestions do you have to make sense of this chaotic catastrophe of where the right wing is taking America?
They have to step back. It's one thing to, for instance, this climate march we're having in New York City coming up in a couple of weeks. That's controlled by the corporations. This march, it's a predetermined route. The police are on board with it. The industries that are, we're complaining about are really in lockstep with this. We really have to step back and say, what are we trying to accomplish here? How can we work together to, instead of hacking away at the branches of these problems and the symptoms, how can we identify the root of the problem? I wrote something, and I want to read it because I'm not very articulate, so let me read this.
Please do. Please do.
To achieve, and I stole this from a friend. To achieve economic, environmental, and social justice requires a mass movement which follows a two-pronged strategy of resistance and creation. It's not sufficient to protect the destructive rule of money, but we must also create alternative systems that place people and planet before profits and show we can replace the existing failed system. Actually, I read that as an introduction. I was at the Left Forum a couple of months ago, and I introduced a group called People for a New Society, and they advocate an economic democracy to replace our failing capitalist system. There are many groups out there, and I'm getting off track here, but there are many groups out there that are really vetting alternative systems. Alternative economic systems, and if you change the economic system, the political system will follow. We have economists such as Richard Wolff. We have Gar Alperowitz, who are advocating co-ops and worker owned enterprises, and these are the things we should be looking at. It's not enough just to rail on against, you know, our terrible healthcare system, which has been described as the worst healthcare system on the planet. It's not enough to rail about fracking. It's not enough to rail about these individual problems. We need to really, as a movement, organize and fight the system which is proximate cause to all of these ills on one prong. And on the other prong, introduce alternative ideas. And they're not fully vetted out. You know, we're going to have problems, but we need to move in a direction that is more harmonious and it's more humane than this suicidal and homicidal system we have. That's all I have to say about that.
Well, you know, I've seen some steps in that direction. I'm old enough to remember when the unions and the good, hard-working people who do so much of the work here, the construction people, were completely against progressive activists. I remember the days when there were riots opposing the anti-war movement in the Vietnam War days, when construction people were misled, and they thought that we were their enemy. And that's so not true then, and it's not true now. But I've recently seen activity where good union activists, environmental activists, social justice advocates, peace workers are starting to come together. There, some of those walls are breaking down. We're seeing the necessity of common cause, which I think is what you're aiming at. And I think it's so important. And I lament like you do that, you know, there's 5,000 groups. My God, there's groups. There's groups and groups and groups and single issue this and single issue that. When we don't need single issue people, we need commonality of interests. The water situation is getting so bad. And Florida is by far not the worst case, but we have such a bad system here. There were recently, last fall, people come together, over 100 different environmental groups came together. And jiminy Christmas, Dave, 100 different environmental groups? How does that make sense? How is that sane? But finally, they came together and said, look, we've got to start working together to protect water because these bastards are selling it out from under us. And you know, I mean, I take heart in that. I take heart when I see union brothers and sisters working with environmentalists, working with human rights and civic rights people. That gives me a lot of hope. But God damn, man, we're on some pretty thin ice right now.
Absolutely. And it's melting as we speak. Well, you know, the answer is education. The answer is people working together, putting down, you know, you're starting me. I should have been on earlier because I could now go. You know, people get wrapped up in the elections. You know, they get wrapped up and they get sold a bill of goods by the, you were talking to one of your guests earlier about, you know, a politician promising this and promising that. Well, of course they're going to do that, but the reality is they don't deliver. They're certainly not accountable. The people that are propped up in front of us, that are running for office, that are supported by the corporate parties, their allegiance is certainly not to us, the people. Their allegiance is to their corporate paymasters. And we can, you know, it really doesn't matter who we vote for, any major party. It doesn't matter. They're all interchangeable. They're all working for the same money. They feed and breed from the same trough. And it's people have to see that, but they get so wrapped up and you know, in their emotions and I've been a Democrat my whole life, or I've done this my whole life, and now I have to do this. And, you know, they're basically just lazy. I'm sorry. The majority of people don't take the time to you know, become informed. And you're not going to get informed by picking up even the New York Times or turning on Channel 4. You know, you're not going to get that. You really have to do some due diligence. You have to look at independent news. Hooray for your program for bringing out issues like that and not being held, you know, hostage to your paymasters. Independent news is huge. You know, I want to plug a friend, Acronym TV. If you've never seen it, watch it. Dennis Traynor Jr. puts on a great program. There's a great internet website called popularresistance.org. Go there every day for news. I strongly recommend it. That's what we have to do. We have to, you know, the front of my house is plastered with signs. That's my message. I have a sign, you know, end illegal foreclosures, stop the NDAA, save the post office, stop bombing schools and children. The entire house is plastered with that. And people stop and they talk. They go, well, I've never heard of Chelsea Manning. Who is that? And we talk. Reach out. If you have something to share, if you're passionate about an issue or issues, engage your neighbors. Engage your friends. You're not going to engage your family, but engage your friends.
Dave, it's wonderful talking to you, my friend. I'm hoping
again.
Well, don't leave just yet. Don't leave just yet. You know, you worked in the anti-war arena. You worked in the foreclosure arena. What's the top of your agenda right now, these days?
Well, I'm fighting a battle with my town. You know, they sent me after 2 years of my signage being up. They sent a notice saying, take down your signs or you will be issued a summons and come to court. And, you know, the funny thing was I was in the car driving home with my wife and I said, you know, I'm really getting tired. I'm just burning out, you know, because I'm going in many, many different directions. I really don't feel like I'm accomplishing much of anything because it's just so overwhelming. And then I get this notice and I'm saying, hot damn, I'm recharged. Because I've been looking forward to this. You know, there's a line in a Jackson Brown song, Lives in the Balance, and the first line is, I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Well, that's the way I feel about these signs, because they keep going up and going up, and now the town wants to challenge me, and I consider this a First Amendment challenge. So I'm very excited about this. So that's at the top of my agenda.
Well, Dave, you know, I've seen some of the signs in your house. I put them up on the animation page of our show because I think that they speak so eloquently to some of the issues of the day. And I just wish you Godspeed, my friend, and all the strength. And I hope you'll agree to come back at least once a month and share your thoughts and your perspectives with us.
I plan on coming to Florida to take one of your courses.
Well, thank you, my friend. Thank you so much. We need activists to speak out. We need people who aren't afraid to stand in the strong wind of public opinion and speak the truth. And I've worked in commercial radio and commercial television for most of my professional career, and I was so appalled at the dreck and had to work so hard to get little splinters of truth through commercial media. I said, I'm going to start producing my own show where truth speakers can come on every week and tell the truth. And there's one thing I've accomplished in this silly life of mine. I've helped a few truth speakers speak to the progressive community. And of that, my friend, I am inordinately proud. And I'm proud to have you as a guest, sir. And with that, my friends, I want to share a little Woody Guthrie with you and a little Pete Seeger. And I hope you'll hear a little of this and say, yes, indeed.
And then we'll see this song come true. We shall.
Welcome back, my friend. I'm sorry. I guess you got cut off, huh?
Well, I warned you my battery might die.
Well, you got time for one last word. Give it to us.
I just want to say thank you so much for the opportunity that you afford, not just myself, but for others to reach out and speak with people. You know, most of us don't own radio stations. We don't own newspapers or magazines. We're so busy, we rarely get a chance to reach out and speak to people. So I want to thank you.
Thank you, my friend. And I'm proud to call you my friend. Dave, keep up the good work.
I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.